Alrighty, this is class two of Greek in Plain English. Last week I gave you guys contact information for me, since there are a couple of new people tonight, and anybody that didn't pay attention last week and said, oh, I wish I really knew what that guy's email was so I could talk to him during the week, you can always get me at john@goodgreeking.com. When you're out on the World Wide Interweb, please visit goodgreeking.com, that's my blog. Every week I try to update with something interesting or fun about Koine Greek or the New Testament, so enjoy that. But that's where you can get a hold of me. Email me. Again, I try to be really good about responding, but if for some reason, you know, it takes me a couple of days, don't keep emailing me saying, why aren't you answering me? I promise I'll get to you. I try to do it within a day, but sometimes it takes a little bit longer. Last week we talked about we talked about the class, that it's going to be 15 weeks, and I gave you the notebooks. Anybody that did not get a notebook that's new, it's going to look great on camera. Here's two notebooks. There you go, and there you go. The suggested donation for the notebooks is $10. If you don't mind, you can pop that in the Pushka box. In the notebooks, in the front, it gives you the itinerary for the class, the syllabus, 15 weeks. Today is the second week, and we're going to look at the alphabet today. One of the big goals of this class is to be able to read the Greek New Testament, particularly to read an interlinear Greek New Testament. I would encourage you guys to get an interlinear New Testament. You can get them on Amazon, Christian discount books, Christian book, whatever the CDB, whatever that is online. Pretty much any interlinear is fine. I recommend that you get one that's tied to the English translation that you're most used to using. If you're an NIV person or an NASB person or a New King James or King James, whatever your English New Testament that you're used to reading, get an interlinear that ties to that, because it'll make more sense for you. Normally interlinears will have the Greek text with a literal English translation under every word of the Greek, and then in the margins, or some of them I think do it at the bottom of the page, they have a modern English translation. So that's why I say, if you're used to reading the NASB, that way you'll have that translation in here to reference to. So I'd recommend getting that. Probably be great to have it by next week, but I understand that, you know, sometimes when you order stuff, it takes a little while to have it delivered. My only caveat on this last week was, if you have one at home that's been sitting dusty up on a shelf for, you know, I don't know, 150 years or something, I probably wouldn't use that one. Get a new one, because that will have a much older Greek text. And at least for me, I think that we ought to be using the most current Greek text that we can. The work of scholars to create a modern Greek text that we can use that is as close as possible to what Paul wrote or what John wrote is hugely important. And over the past 50, 60 years, they've made great strides in that. So try to get one that's fairly new. Again, probably something back printed in the 60s, late 50s is probably still fine. But once you get much older than that, it starts to, your text may be a little bit old on the Greek text. And what will happen is it just won't match up occasionally with something I might show you or something you might see in a commentary or something. There might be a little variant on that. Nothing huge, nothing that comes along and says there's 47 people in the Trinity or something. There's no kinds of variant readings that say those kind of things. But it's just kind of good to be fairly consistent with the text used. Try to be as contemporary as possible. Okay, last week we talked about language. I said that language is this incredible process of communication that human beings do. And I talked about what to me is just almost a miraculous physiological process of how it works when we communicate. How one of us can make sounds and the other person can hear those sounds and they mean things. You know, it makes sense to you. You know, and we have this cultural ability to understand each other, right? And if I say, you know, the dog has black spots, you don't think, oh, he wants me to go buy a loaf of bread. You know, I mean, we have this marvelous cultural compact where we all agree on language. So that's, we talked about that process last week. This week we're going to talk about the alphabet, which again is this idea of language, but now the alphabet becomes written language. And written language is sort of, it's one of the great inventions of all of mankind. You know, if you think about, you know, the really great things that mankind has done, written language is huge. You know, landing on the moon, inventing computers, frozen pizza. The remote control for the TV, I think, is one of the great all-time things ever that our culture has created. But written language allows us to do certain things that we couldn't do before it came along. Prior to written language, everything was in the oral tradition. If I wanted to speak to you guys, I had to be here to speak to you guys. This is before the age where we had, you know, digital pocket recorders and the internet and video and everything. It used to be if you wanted to say something to someone before written language, you had to be there. And once you said it, it was gone. And if you said it in front of 10 people, and 5 of them heard it one way and 5 of them heard it another way, they could argue about it. Written language, something just beeped. Okay, written, as long as it's not me, I don't care. Written language allows us now to do two things. One, it allows us to record language, right? Your pastor gives this tremendous sermon, and 3 years later, because they wrote it down, you can pick it up and read a copy of it, and you'll get the exact same thing that he said that day he originally gave it. It allows commerce. You know, if you're back in antiquity and I'm trading you some olive oil for some barley, you know, we can make a deal. And I say, okay, I'm going to give you 2 barrels of olive oil and I want 4 sacks of barley. And we agree on that. It allows me to write that down so that we both have that same agreement written down. And now when I come to deliver the oil or you come to deliver the barley, we look at it and go, yep, there's 2 for 4. Okay, way to go. We write paid in full. Thank you very much. It allowed commerce to have written language. So written language does a lot. The second thing that written language actually does is it allows you to communicate by yourself. My blog, when I write my blog posts, I'm sitting in front of my computer. I don't have anybody there. And I'm typing away with my mangled little 2 or 3 finger typing skills, and then I post it. And then sometime later, people come along and read it. An author writes a novel, spends months, maybe years writing a novel. It gets published. That author has worked by themselves. But because of written language, they can put this stuff in a form that then later on can be read by somebody. So oral communication, you have to have people there. Written language, you can do it in isolation and then share it later. The other thing that written language allows is what can be said or communicated can then be transported way outside of the area where the person originally communicated it. If all we could do was just verbally speak, then I'm talking to you guys tonight, the folks in Fillmore up in Ventura County, they don't know what I'm saying, right? But if we write down what I said tonight, and then somebody took it, you know, mailed it up to Fillmore, then they could read it up there. So what I said here can now be transported. And this is all part of what written language allows us to do. So, originally all language, I believe, was verbal. We didn't have written language. And even after we started to have written language, the emphasis, I believe, still was on oral communication. If you look in Western society, the great epic poems of Western society, the Iliad and the Odyssey by Homer, Beowulf, even stretching it a little bit, the Kalevala, these great epic poems were originally done as part of the oral tradition. And people would practice. I mean, these, if you've ever read these, you know they're very long works of literature. And people would practice being able to repeat them and almost perform them for folks. And years before they were written down, they were all just simply oral communication. They were just physically someone had to say them out loud. But eventually we started to write stuff down. Most folks think that in the West, The first kind of writing was done, they basically had a pointy stick. It would look sort of, the end of it would look kind of like a flathead screwdriver almost. And they'd have this big piece of soft clay. And they would take the pointy stick and they would press it into the clay. And they would make little marks, you know, little mark there, little mark here, little mark there. And that meant something. And then they'd go over and they'd make another couple little marks and that meant something, and so on and so on. And then once they got done pressing this pointy stick into the soft clay, they'd put it out in the sun or they'd heat it in a kiln, and it would now become this solid thing. And so now you could take it with you, or you could show it to somebody else, or you could, if you said, oh, I never said that, they could say, oh, wait a minute, back here on this big 50-pound slab of hard clay that I have, see, right there. You see, you said it right there. So the earliest form of writing was this sort of pointy stick making little marks in clay. It's called a cuneiform, and normally there may be different early forms, but that seems to be the earliest form. Gradually, written communication, written language, followed another path which brought us to the alphabet. If I wanted to tell you guys something, I would create a symbol for it that we would all agree on meant that thing. Right? So if I came along and I went, and I said, okay, I have an ox. There's my ox. Okay? So I would show you that picture and I'd say, ox. And you guys would go, oh, yep, ox. He's got an ox. And if I wanted to see your ox, I'd say, hey, show me your ox. You'd show me your ox, right? If I had more than one, I could draw five of them up there, and I'd say, oh, I got five oxes, oxen, right? The plural of ox in English. And so the symbol represented the thing, okay? And they would name the symbol. This particular symbol, by the way, was called, in early Semitic language, it was Aleph or Aleph. If you speak Hebrew, you would know the letter Aleph. In a minute, we're going to see how this got into Greek. So this little thing, Aleph or Alf here, was this thing that they originally had. It's this picture of an ox. Okay, gradually, what was a picture of a thing also became a picture of an idea, right? Here's an ox. Now, what is an ox? An ox is something that I've trained to plow my field or pull a cart or do something. So now the idea of this ox is now the idea of tame or trained, right? So now this same thing here that originally meant ox was the symbol for a thing, now also becomes a symbol for an idea, and that idea is to tame or to train something. So if I said, hey, you know what, we need to train you guys up in Greek, well, I could write that with this symbol, because now we've all agreed, all of us who speak this language would agree that this not only means the thing ox, but the idea of trained or tame. Does that make sense? You see where that goes? Okay. Gradually, as this goes, it kind of changes a little bit, and it gets a little more symbol-like. This one actually had little eyes on it. A little more symbol-like, and it starts now we don't even call this ox anymore. You know, you'd call this, you'd go, oh yeah, that's ox. But now this is starting to just no longer be an ox. Now it's starting to be this idea. And this Aleph, which was the name for ox, now becomes the name for this symbol. And pretty soon as it goes along, now that symbol no longer represents a thing, no longer represents just an idea. Because of the name of it, in this case, Aleph, it starts to represent the sound that you make when you say that word, Aleph, right? So now this gets even further removed and becomes, in Greek, alpha. Okay? So what started out as this ox, way back when, picture of something so we could communicate, became the picture of an idea. Now it became an abstract symbol that represents a particular sound. In this case, because the Greeks called it alpha, it represents a sound, a. Right, that kind of A sound, for want of a better term. So this little ox head has now become the a sound in Greek. You guys see how that happens? That's how alphabets started, okay? The Phoenicians, as I said last week, were really good with this sort of stuff. And everybody who dealt with the Phoenicians, whether they be Semitic tribes or Greeks or whoever it was in those areas, all sort of borrowed the Phoenician alphabet and borrowed these symbols. The Greek alphabet owes a lot to the Phoenician alphabet. But that's also the reason why, and we'll see this tonight as we go through the Greek alphabet, you'll notice that it has a lot in common with our modern English alphabet. And it'll have a lot in common with the order of the Hebrew alphabet as well. So, and the reason why is everybody borrowed from the Phoenicians. Okay? All right. Alphabets, as we get to this stage of them, you know that word, by the way, alphabet is not really a word. Alphabet is just the first two letters of Greek, alpha and beta. And we combine it, and when we refer to the symbol pattern that represents sounds within a language, we go, oh yeah, it's the alpha and beta, you know, it's the alphabet. And so by the time we get to now, here in the 21st century, it actually is a word for us in English. Alphabet really is a word. It's a lot like, I always say, it's kind of like, you know, when kids go to school, you know, like in kindergarten, you know, and you say, hey, what are you guys doing at school day? They go, oh, we're learning our ABCs. Well, ABCs is not a word, but they've taken the first three letters of the English alphabet and used it to represent the sum total of learning all the sound symbols within that. And an alphabet within a culture, within a society, is an agreement. We all agree that this thing is an A sound, right? In English, we all agree that B is B as in boy, right? And so we've all agreed on that. So we all know the English alphabet. And that allows us to communicate, because then we take those different sound symbols and put them together, we get a word, right? And we all agree on that because we all speak English. So we all agree on the sounds that those alphabetic symbols represent. In our case, our alphabet is shared by a whole lot of different language speakers. What we call the English alphabet is shared by people that, you know, speak all the common languages we bump into, right? Spanish, French, Italian, German, Latin, you know, they all use the same alphabet, which allows us to interact with those other languages in a similar manner, right? All we have to do is learn what their word for something is, the meaning of that word. We don't have to learn a new alphabet like we're going to do tonight, right? In English, we're a Germanic language, right? We have our word for the color of this board is white, right? And we know that in English, right? W-H-I-T-E. We know that's white. And we know how to say it. It's white. But let's say we wanted to learn another language. So we go and say, well, what's the word for white in that other language? And it may be blanco. Or it may just be blanc. Right? Now, all we have to do is learn that this word means the same as this word, and we're good, right? We don't have to learn a different alphabet because even though it's a different word, it's the exact same symbol of sounds. B, L, A, N, K, O. We all know that. We don't speak this language. We speak this language, but we all share the same alphabet. So having a common system of sounds, an alphabetic system of sounds, helps us as we're dealing with other languages. Not the case if you want to learn Mandarin, right? In Mandarin, the alphabet looks completely different. I tried to pick a language that was radically different looking than ours. In that case, you have to learn the completely different alphabetic system as well as all this other stuff that instead of white, it means this other word, right? So we're lucky. The alphabet that we use is shared in common with a whole lot of other languages. Okay, so let's take a look at the Greek alphabet. In your books, these pages are not numbered. That is not Hadavar's fault. That is mine, because I gave them all this information. You will see a page that says the Koine Greek alphabet, and there are four columns, uppercase, lowercase, name, and pronunciation. Okay? We're going to spend the next half hour or so painfully and slowly going through every one of these. No, it won't be that bad. This is the Greek alphabet. Greek, just like English, has an upper and a lower case. The majority of people that ever learn Greek, unless you're in a fraternity, only learn the lower case. They never seem to learn the upper case. I taught first year Greek for a number of years, and I always laugh. My students never seemed to learn uppercase. They knew all the lowercase stuff. They rarely knew all the uppercase stuff. They knew the big ones, you know, alpha and delta and epsilon and whatnot, but they didn't get all of them. So I would encourage you guys to learn both those columns, okay, the uppercase and lowercase. Then I have the name of the letter. Now, the thing about Greek is the name of the letter carries the sound of the letter, right? Remember I said that was how alphabet systems evolved. The sound of the letter became part of the name, or the name gave us the sound of the letter. So we start out with alpha, and the A sound is in father. It's an A sound. I said this last week. Realize that I pronounce things slightly different than you might pronounce them. So when I say the A is in father, okay, it's an A sound. It may sound a little more A to you, a little more aw to somebody else. So just within that general range. What A is never in Greek, alpha in Greek is never A. In English, the letter A in English can be A as in father, so it's an A sound. It could be A as in hat, so it's an A sound. It could be A as in cake, right? So it's an A sound. So in English, the letter A has three different sounds that it could be. And probably with regional dialects, a few more. In Greek, that's not the case. Alpha is always going to be, the A is in father. It's always going to be an A sound. Whenever you see alpha, say it as A. Beta, it's the B sound. It's a B, okay? B is in bet. Here's where we shift a little bit. In English, we go A, B, C. In Greek, we go alpha, beta, gamma, right? Now, here's the first difference. Notice the gamma. Looks like this, right? We have an English letter that looks like that, okay? This is gamma, this is Y. Do not say gamma in Greek thinking Y of English. Even though it looks like that, it actually won't. The fonts for Greek actually make it a little kind of squiggly and curly up on top. They kind of do this little curve thing there, and they kind of do that little bottom thing. So it doesn't quite look like an English Y, but if you are reading quick in low light, it may look like a Y. It's not. It's gamma. It's the hard G sound. G as in go. Gamma will never be a soft G sound. It will never be the G like in gem, okay? It's always going to be the hard G sound, as in go. But don't get it confused with the English Y. Okay, and then we get back into the same sequence as English alphabet, right? D. D is in dog. Delta has the hard D sound. All of these letters, by the way, you know, I gave you the example of alpha. Originally started out as a picture of an ox head. All of these letters started that way. Beta started out as a house. Gamma was a camel. Delta was a door. Actually, it was a tent flap that when folks really went uptown started making buildings with actual doors and not flaps. Gamma or Delta was the door. So all of these had that kind of origin. And that's kind of a fun thing sometimes to look those up. So we have Delta, D as in dog, Epsilon. Now here, Epsilon is an A sound, as in net, okay? It is in English, remember our vowels can be short or long, right? Epsilon in Greek is never anything other than A. It's never E. So when you see an epsilon, don't say it as an E sound. It's always an A sound, okay? This is kind of interesting. Epsilon, and later we'll get down here to upsilon. The name is actually a compound word. Psilon in Greek means plain. I think there's a range on it, but the best definition is probably plain. So this is plain E, okay? Epsilon, plain E. You can think of it that way, because later on we're going to get to eta, which is a long A sound, but that's thinking of E is a little fancier that way for you. But just think of epsilon as plain E. It's just E as in net. And then the letter that we have at the end of our alphabet is right in the front part of the Greek alphabet, zeta. That's a crazy little character. Doesn't look anything like English. It kind of looks like a Z if it, I don't know, kind of got in an accident and got stretched out and munched or something. But you just have to learn that symbol, okay? This is where, when you're learning language, different things in language, sometimes just rote memorization is necessary. In this case, you just learn to look at that and say, yep, that's a zeta. And it's the Z sound as in zoo. Although, we say Z sounds differently in English. Sometimes we say them as a pure Z, you know, like buzz. Sometimes we say them as if they had T's or D's in them. Z, right? So it's just the general Z sound. Again, you'll get used to this as you pronounce things. And again, the good news for us is there are no living folks who speak this Koine Greek. So the best we can do here is we get an approximation of it. I would tell you that it's best to be consistent. If you're a little off in the ah of alpha, if you're more of an ah than an ah, at least be consistent and always say it that way, because you need to train your ears to hear those sounds so that as you're reading the words and as you're learning definitions of words, you pronounce the word the same way every time. Our brains work, our brains are incredible, but our brains love consistency when it comes to learning, okay? Our brains learn better if they hear the same sound over and over and over again, consistently the same way. So when you're learning language, try to always say these letters the same. Okay, eta. Now, eta is another one that can be confusing. Eta looks a little bit like an English N, right? It's eta, and we all know N looks like that, okay? Eta is the long A sound in Greek. Eta, again, remember the sound of the letter is in its name, eta. Usually the way you know that it's an eta is the right-hand corner of it's a little bit longer. It extends down just slightly, whereas our N always stays the same. But it's not an N sound. It's an A sound in Greek. So eta. Okay, so we got alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, zeta, eta, theta. Here's another new letter. It's an O with a line in the middle of it, okay? It's the TH sound, okay? It's TH as in the. The word theos, the word for God in Greek, uses a theta to begin with, right? So we get this, the th sound. Notice that theta has the sound of an eta in the middle of it, right? It's the TH sound with an eta, if that helps at all in learning it. Okay, the next one looks like an I, in our English alphabet. It doesn't have a little dot over it. If you're used to signing your I's with little dots and smiley faces or hearts, you won't be able to do that in Greek. I'm sorry, you just can't do that. There is no dot over the I in Greek. And it's pronounced Yoda, exactly like that little guy in Star Wars. Okay? Yoda is an interesting little letter. You pronounce it as the I in tip, so it's an I sound. But occasionally, Yoda does this really cool thing. A long time ago, by the way, that's an omega. We'll be getting to it. They would write omega Yoda. And then for whatever reason, I don't know why. I've really read about this, and I can't find out anybody give one real definite answer of why. They got tired of writing that. And they started to write it like this. Omega, and they wrote the I underneath of it, okay? That's called a subscripted Yoda. You will see a subscripted Yoda under etas. You will see a subscripted Yoda under alphas, okay? And that's a Yoda. It's just dropped under the other letter, okay? So I don't know why it does that. Like I say, I've read a lot about that because I just find that really interesting. But while they tell you the process, nobody really tells me why. Maybe I'll Maybe I'll find out. Maybe you'll find out if you're really good at Google. If it's on what's the Wikipedia? Don't believe it, but try to find another source. So Yoda by itself is an is sound, as in tip, but it does subscript sometimes under other letters. Okay, Kappa, this is an easy one. This is a lot like English. It looks like an English K, and it sounds like the English K, like the K in kitten. Here's another new letter. This one doesn't look like anything in English, lambda. That's the L sound. L is in love, okay? And notice that one's kind of like an upside-down gamma. Right? Gamma was this. So it's kind of like we flipped it almost, okay? But that's the L sound. When you see that, again, it's one of those characters like zeta or eta that we just don't have that in English. Oh, here's a point. Let me take a moment to tell you about writing this stuff out. We're going to talk about writing these letters out. And I would encourage you over the certainly this coming week, but over the course of this class, write these letters out, practice them, okay? That's part of the learning process of getting this stuff in your head. When you write it, don't become a you're not doing calligraphy here. I know that, you know, I use these little fonts, right? My computer has like 3 or 4 different Greek fonts, so I don't have to handcraft these letters. You see what my Greek writing looks like, okay? When I write an alpha, sometimes I write it like that. Sometimes I write it like that, okay? More often than not, I write it like that, okay? I know it's an English letter A. It works, okay? When you get to these things like lambda, you know, don't worry that, okay, I've got to arch this top and I've got to come down and then I have to about this far. You know, just don't do that, you know? Just do it so it looks like a lambda, but don't make yourself crazy over it. Unless you're really into calligraphy and that sort of stuff, and then knock yourself out. I mean, that's fine. But in general, don't spend your whole day crafting the letter. Mu is the M sound. M is in man. Notice this one looks like an English U, right? Don't confuse mu with an English U. Now, there's a way to differentiate it. Mu in Greek and U in English. Mu has this little front part on it here, okay? So if you see this little front thing, you know it's not a U, okay? So don't make that. There is a U-looking letter in Greek, so don't confuse mu and the U-looking letter upsilon, okay? So that's the M sound, and it's got this little tag on the left-hand side there. Okay, the thing that looks like a V in English is the Greek letter nu, and it's the N sound. Don't confuse it with the English letter V. All right, it is now 7. Mark this down your calendar. This is momentous. I wish there was a trumpet fanfare somewhere for this. Right now, at 7:40, I am going to teach you your first Greek joke. I'm telling you, this is, you know, you pay $1.25 for this class, I give you $2.75 worth of stuff. That's how good this is. Okay, your first Greek joke. Somebody comes up to you and says, "Hey, what's new?" You go, "The 13th letter of the Greek alphabet." Ba-dum-bum. All right. That's why a lot of people don't come back for the second Greek class, right? But that joke is just, I learned that when I first learned Greek. I have taught that joke to every single Greek class I have ever taught. My kids at home have heard that since my kids are grown up, right? Since they were this tall, they hate that joke. Now you can go on to alienate your friends and family telling that same joke. What's new? 13th letter of the Greek alphabet. Okay, the next one is Z. Now this one looks kind of like that other Greek letter, zeta, right? It's zeta with a little thing in the middle of it. So you've got to learn now. Now you're no longer trying to differentiate between a Greek letter and an English letter. Now you're trying to differentiate between two Greek letters, right? Because zeta does this little thing, right? And this one does this little thing. So it's got a little job in the middle of it there, right? So Z has it kind of like we do E and F, right? You know, E has 3 little bars, whereas F only has 2. It's kind of a similar idea. The sound here is the X sound, but not the hard X sound, it's the X sound, right? X as in exit. And again, Z, like in xylophone, except you pronounce the X a little bit stronger there. Z, the sound of the letter is in its name. Z has the X sound as in exit. All right, Omicron. Omicron is like our English letter O, but again, because English vowels can be long or short, Greek vowels don't. Greek vowels only have one sound. So the Omicron is like the O in hot, so it's an ah sound. I always confuse alpha and omicrons when I pronounce them out loud, because they both, in my ears, have an ah sound. Now, as I tell a good friend of mine who helps me out editing stuff I write, I am orthographically challenged in multiple languages. What that means is I'm a lousy speller. I'm a really bad speller in English. I'm a bad speller in Greek, too, because, again, I hear ah, and I write an omicron, or I write an alpha, and sure enough, it should have been the other sometimes. So don't get those two confused. Alpha and omicron are two different letters, but they have a very similar sound, an ah sound. I know if I was a speech therapist, and I said A is in father and O is in hot, I would tell you that those are two different sounds. But I'm not. To me, those are the same sound. So don't confuse those as you're spelling. The O, the omicron is an ah sound. The A is the alpha is an ah sound as in father. Now here, omicron is another one of these kind of compound words. There are two O sounds in Greek. There's omicron, which is an ah, and there's omega, which is an O. Their names are compound words. Omicron, mikron in Greek means small or little. Mega in Greek means big. Omicron is the little O. Omega is the big O. Okay, so if that helps you in learning this stuff, remember that we have two different types of O's there. All right, the next one. Despite the movie that's getting all the buzz for Oscar and everything, Life of Pi, it's pronounced in Greek, P. It's not pronounced pi. I know if you've been in math classes or science classes, you grew up seeing this symbol as pi. Everybody knows this one. Even folks that that don't know Greek know pi, but it's pronounced P. Okay? And I know that's tough to get over always hearing it your whole life as pi, but it's P. The sound it makes is the letter P as in pillow, but the pronunciation of the letter itself is P, not pi. The thing that looks like an R in English or I'm sorry, it looks like a P in English is rho in Greek. It's the R sound. Okay? But it looks I do that and I do that and you say, okay, that's rho and that's P in English. Don't get it confused. Okay, when you see this, make the R sound. When you see this, make the P sound. Make sense? Okay. Okay, sigma. Sigma's interesting. Sigma is the S sound. And there are two ways we can write sigma. Okay, it's the S as in sand. We can write sigma this way. Okay, or we can write sigma this way. Two different ways of doing it. I don't know if any of you here know Hebrew. Several letters in Hebrew have two different forms. Several letters in Arabic, if you know Arabic, have three different forms, depending on where the letter falls. In Arabic, if a letter falls at the beginning of a word or in the middle of a word or the end of a word, it could have a different form. In Hebrew, letters have a different form if they're in the beginning or middle of a word than if they're at the end of the word. In Greek, there's only one of those, and that's sigma. Anytime you use sigma in a word where it is the first or any other letter except the last one, you write it like this. It looks like an O with a little kind of arm on it sticking out. If sigma is the last letter of a word, you write it like this. This version of sigma looks much more like our English S, okay? Especially when I draw it like that. It's the same letter. It's the same sound, S as in sand, okay? But it is written differently depending on where it occurs in the word. And is everybody tracking with that? Or have I lost anybody? Okay. I ask you guys that a lot because I don't want to assume that everybody gets what I'm saying and then motor along and 20 minutes later, you're still going, oh, what did he mean? So it's not that I'm questioning that you guys don't get this stuff. It's just kind of my technique of making sure that I don't leave anybody in the dust. So if I ask you guys, you got that? Is that, you make sense? I don't mean it at all to demean your intelligence. It's just I want to make sure that what I'm saying is clear. By the way, over these 15 weeks, it will probably happen that I say something and you scratch your head and go, okay, I have no clue what he just meant by that. Please let me know and I'll re-say it. I have found that even though in my brain I'm perfectly clear and articulate and I know exactly what I'm trying to express, that doesn't always come across when you hear it. So feel free to stop me if there's something that I say that you don't get. I try to ask as I go along. Okay, so we have two different forms of sigma. Beginning or any other letter, end of a word. Okay? All right. Then we go to tau. Okay, tau looks just like an English T, and that's what it is. It's the T sound. T is in top. Okay? Now we get upsilon. Now, upsilon is another one of our compound word letters, right? Psilon means plain. This is upsilon, so it's plain oops, right? Just like eta was plain eta, epsilon. It looks like our English letter U, but it's really pronounced like we pronounce the double O in boot. It's oo, okay? If you're from Canada, you're oot in a boot, right? So it has that sound. It is not quite like a German umlaut, which is... a vowel pronounced with rounded lips. Okay, it's not like that. It really is like the oo in boot. So when you see upsilon, say it as oo in boot. Again, the sound of the letter is within its name. Okay, now the last several letters here they don't look anything like letters in English. Okay, these are all they're sounds that we don't have for letters in English. Well, we do have for fee. We have F. Circle with a line through it. That's the F sound. F is in father. It's actually the PH sound, right? But it's the F is in father. Then the way you can kind of think of this is if you take theta, which is the TH sound, and rotate it, you get the F sound, okay? Certain letters have a tendency to migrate their sounds back and forth in language. You find this in a whole lot of languages. B. The sound B, the letter B, has a tendency to migrate over to the sound of V in language. Good example is here in California. Our state is run by a governor. But when we elect the governor, that election is called the gubernatorial election. The V has shifted to a B. Okay? Some of these sounds, F sounds, TH sounds, D sounds, sometimes migrate like that. You guys know all the fairy tale stories, right? Grimm's fairy tales? Well, the Grimm boys, not only did they write all these fairy tales, but they were linguists, okay? And they wrote a lot about language. And in fact, they cataloged in a very nice form how these letters shift in sounds within languages. And it's called Grimm's Law. If you can Google it, you look up Grimm's Law, and you'll see how some of these sounds have a tendency to migrate back and forth. I'm telling you that just because it's more knowledge, helps you to learn this stuff better, but you will find occasionally, We don't really talk about it in here, the square of stops and whatnot, and how letters combine and move. But Grimm's Law is very interesting along that way. And it's the same guys that wrote the fairy tales, by the way, Grimm's Fairy Tales. There's a book that I'd highly recommend for you guys to get. Did I bring my copy? That's the question. Yes, I did. Okay, this is an ancient copy. This was found at the early digs in Sumeria in 200 BC. No, this is a really old copy of this because I got this used when I first started doing Greek. So this is an old copy. It looks much nicer nowadays. It's called Lexical Aids for Students of New Testament Greek by Bruce Metzger. Bruce Metzger is a genius. This guy is just great. He does so much work with the Greek text and with Koine Greek and whatnot. And this book is wonderful. It's a small book. It catalogs in alphabetical order the most common occurring words in the New Testament. And it groups them in nice little bundles so you can learn them. He gives you all the words that are 500 times or more in the New Testament. And then he gives you all the words that are 200 to 500 times. And he goes on down to, I think it's been a while since I went through it, the words that are, I should have looked this up ahead of time. Didn't know I was going to be talking about it. Words that occur 10 times or more. And he lists them, and he lists the word, and he gives its meanings, and then a lot of times he'll give you little, like a mnemonic device almost, like an English word that sounds like that word, like biblos. Okay, biblos means book in Greek, but we get our word Bible from biblos, so that's a way to help you learn, oh, biblos means book, the Bible is a book. Okay, so I'd strongly recommend this. The reason why this jumped out at me was that in the back of this, somewhere, he has a description of Grimm's Law. Well, I'm not going to look it up now, but it's in here. And it's a real interesting little thing to look at. It's how consonant shifts take place in language. So anyway, I strongly recommend you get that book. It's a great book for learning your Greek vocabulary. Part of your notes, I'm working on it now to give it to them, and they'll print it out and give it to you to put in your books, is a Greek lexicon of the most common words that I think you guys need to know. But this is a good help as well. Okay, back to our stuff. So we did phi. It's the F as in father, right? Now we have key. Now this one looks like our X in English. Okay? But it's really pronounced as the CH, the hard CH, as in like in Bach, right? It doesn't kind of have that Bach, it doesn't kind of have that sound to it. It's not like hate in Hebrew. I have a bad Greek accent. I had an absolutely brutal Hebrew accent. My poor first year prof in Hebrew. I was terrible. And I really did bad on hate. I just, it was bad. But anyway, this is more of a hard, like a K sound almost. Like key is like the CH in Bach. But again, the sound of the letters in its name, key, right? Key. Next page, the last two letters. We have C. Which looks just like Poseidon's trident. Right? And that's the sound it makes. It's a PS. It's like oops. Right? PS. C. So you say the P and you say the S together. Ps, right? So C. And then the very last one, which all of us know. We all know the first letter in the Greek alphabet, and we all know the last because over and over and over in church, we have heard Jesus referred to as the Alpha and the Omega. Okay, and the very last letter in Greek, Omega, looks like a W in English, but it's the O sound. It's what we would call the long O sound. This is another one of those compound. Remember, Omicron, Omicron, right? The small O. This is the big O, Omega. Okay, those are the Greek letters. Now, you need to memorize them. That I used to tell students in first year Greek, the very first night of class, and I would say it over and over and over again, the thing about learning a language is you have to memorize. No matter how snappy and playful the instructor might make it when he teaches, you still have to go home and memorize. That's the ugly, dark secret of learning a language, right? And so I strongly recommend that you memorize this Greek alphabet. That's the way you learn this stuff. It's the way we learned English, right? As little wee kids, we used to go into kindergarten and we'd learn our alphabet, right? And then we'd get those, if you're close to my age, you had those books that said, see John Run, see Spot, right? The little first readers, right? And we learned our alphabet and we'd sound out our words, right? It's the exact same thing in Greek, okay? So you need to memorize this. Now, the way you can memorize it, the way we memorized in English was we had a little song, right? I'm sure everybody here knows the alphabet song in English, right? A, B, C, D, right? You know that one? Everybody knows that? I have to confess, I was a senior in college. I was working as an assistant up in the office of the Religious Studies Department. I'm filing, and here I am, a young man about to graduate from college with my bachelor's degree, and no lie, I would still occasionally have to sing that song in my head to make sure I knew where K was in relationship as I'm filing it, right? So it's very helpful. Now, I did not make this myself. I stole this from Bill Mounts, who is an excellent Greek teacher. Probably the best first-year grammar that's out there right now is by Bill Mounts. And it's a way to memorize the Greek letters based on the song Shortening Bread. I don't know if you're all familiar with the song Shortening Bread. I can play this without having to pay anybody money because it is in the public domain. So here is a way to... The guy on this recording didn't. That's a real helpful thing, because that little sucker gets stuck in your head like the It's a Small World song at Disneyland, okay? And you will walk around going, you know, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, and it'll just get stuck in there, but it'll help you learn it. So I strongly recommend, you're welcome to use that song if you want to, or if there's another way you can do it. Hebrew, there's a couple of songs you do Hebrew. There's the Barney song, and then there's another one. But this is the best one I've found for Greek, is Shortening Bread, and it's doing the alphabet to that. If you go to, I'm trying to remember the website, two websites, biblicalgreek.org is a very good site, all kinds of resources and stuff. I think that this is probably at... I don't know the complete address, and I am afraid to go on the internet without a complete address because you never know what kind of crazy wacko place you're going to end up. But if you go to Google and type in Technia, you should get a hit that'll get you to the website that's the Technia Greek website. Technia is a Greek word for child. And Bill Mounts, a lot of folks do, they talk about when you're first learning Greek, you're learning baby Greek. That's a real common phrase. People say, oh yeah, you know, I was real good in baby Greek, or yeah, I got some guys really struggling with their baby Greek. Technia is just the Greek word for little child, and I'm sure that's why Mounts chose that for this. But again, Google that. I don't know if it's technia.com, technia.org, I'm not sure on that, but Google it first. And that will probably have this. Oh, okay. So you may be able to find this on there. Again, it doesn't have to be that song. If you really need this, I'll get this to Bob, and he can get it to you somehow, or I can email it to you, whatever. I don't have it as a download off of my site. Sorry about that. I'm not that sophisticated yet. But you need to put this in some way that you can become familiar with these letters when you memorize them. Now, the best way to learn how to learn a new alphabet is to do what's called transliterate. Big fancy word. It means to write words that you know using the letters from the alphabet you're trying to learn. You write words you know. You write English words, but instead of our English alphabet, you use the Greek letters, right? So, if I wrote, let's see, what would be a good one to write? I could write box, right? That would be using Greek letters to write the English word that's represented by box. The B is in beta, right? B. A is in omicron. Z, right? The X sound. Box, right? We could write dog, and dog would look kind of similar. There's dog in Greek, right? D delta for the D sound, omicron, and then the gamma for the G. You see what I'm doing? I'm writing English words, the sounds of the English words, but to represent those sounds, I'm using the Greek letters. Everybody tracking with that? I could write my blog's name in Greek, right? I would write, and I would have a choice here. Do I write two omicrons? What else could I write there for the oo sound? Because two omicrons would be god. What else could I write for the oo sound? I could write an upsilon there, right? So instead of, in English, it would be good, like this. In Greek, I can get away with just three letters. Good. You see how that happened? The sound that upsilon makes is the oo is in boot. The double O that's in good, right? It's close enough. This is more of a and this is more of an oo sound, but it's, again, it's close enough for what we're doing. So good would be that. And then I could go on to write. Now here, I got to write an E sound. So we don't have a really good E sound. What do you guys think we ought to use? We could use Yoda. It's more of an I sound. This one we probably can't equate over. I mean, we honestly can't. Wow, it's almost like I planned that, so we'd have to figure it out. Okay, so this one we really can't. This one you could just go ahead and I would write a double epsilon, right? So I would just write, right? And then the rest of it. But you get that. There may be some sounds that we make that they don't make in Greek. I could write the girl's name Sue in Greek by writing sigma and upsilon. Sue, right? In English, this is a diphthong, upsilon and U and E, and we get that oo sound. In Greek, we've just got it here. What if I wanted to write my name John? How would I write that in Greek?
You'd write that in Greek form of it?
Yeah, that's right. In Greek, it's Ioannis. I'll do it like this. Okay, I'd write that in Greek. Greek doesn't have a J sound. There's no J sound in Greek. they substituted, well, we brought over the Yoda into English as the J. So Ioannis in Greek is John, in English is John, right? Notice there's no H sound either. There actually is. We're going to talk about that now. The H sound in Greek is a way that you pronounce certain letters with what we call rough or smooth breathing. Go over to the page that comes after the big alphabet page. You see at the very bottom is this word breathing marks. Again, that's my fault. That should have been up on the next page. Go to the next page. You'll see Greek has two breathing marks. Okay? One looks like an apostrophe going that way, and the other one looks like an apostrophe going that way. You see those? Okay. When you see this, that's called a rough breathing, and you would stick an H in front of the sound. So if you see in Greek this, omicron is ah. This is sigma because it's the last letter, right? So it's the second form of sigma, the ending form. So this is os. But with this mark over it, it's hos. Does that make sense? There's a Greek word, omicron t iota. Okay? It's a preposition in Greek. And it has a rough breathing over the omicron. So this is actually pronounced in English haughty. This is ha t. And I know I said iota is the is sound. In this case, it's pronounced haughty. Everybody pronounces it that way. But it's that breathing mark. When you see this one, you put an H in front of it. When you see the smooth breathing, you don't add any additional H. It's just regular. So if you see a letter with nothing or with this, starting out and going to the left, there is no H in front of it. If you see a vowel with a rough breathing over it, starting going to the lower right, you put an H in front of it. Did I just lose everybody on that? You'll get the hang of this, okay? You'll get the hang of it as you go along. There are accent marks in Greek that you'll see in your Greek text. Accent marks were originally there to show you pitch and inflection on words. There's three, acute, circumflex, and grave, or grave if you like, I don't care. Basically for us, for this class, all those accent marks are going to tell you is what syllable gets the emphasis. The same way an accent mark in English will tell you what syllable gets the emphasis. Why is that important? Sometimes it's important because you can have a word spelled exactly the same in Greek, two different words, and the only difference is the accent mark. And it makes a big difference in the translation. But in general, why that makes a big difference for us is that it tells us what syllable gets the emphasis, so it helps us to consistently pronounce the word the same way every time. Right? Because consistency is important in learning in our learning Greek. Okay, the only other thing that we need to look at, and then you'll have learned absolutely everything you need to pronounce and read Greek, okay? Except experience. You go back to that previous page, and we have the diphthongs. Greek has seven main diphthongs that you need to know. You guys see them there? Alpha and iota together is pronounced like aisle. I. Okay? Epsilon and iota together is like the A in eight, or height. Omicron and iota together is oi, as in oive. No, oi as in oil. Alpha and upsilon together is the ow of sauerkraut. So it's like that ow sound. Omicron and upsilon together is the oo sound of soup. So we could have said on our oo sound before, we could have done omicron epsilon, or we could do omicron. Spelling, especially in antiquity, was really kind of loosey-goosey, okay? Folks spelled a lot of times like they heard it. And sometimes folks spelled things based on the dialect of the language they spoke. A real good example is when you're studying the history of English and you go to Old English, pre-Chaucer type of English. The different dialects of Old English, Northumbrian, Wessex, those different forms of Old English. The spelling in the old manuscripts, and there's really only a handful of them, but the spelling, the same word can be spelled three or four different ways in the exact same text. A lot of that had to do with the dialect, with how they heard it. So spelling was a little loose back in antiquity. Nowadays, we're reading something that's been encoded, fixed in place, has not changed in, you know, almost 2,000 years. So the spelling is always going to be the same. But know that as you're doing this exercise this week of writing English words with Greek spelling, if you have an U sound and you write upsilon, or you have an U sound and you write omicron upsilon, either way is just fine. Okay? Because thousands of years from now, when they dig up the handwritten note that you have done, and it's in a museum someplace, they will argue over the spelling that you've done as whether it was conventional within modern spelling of ancient Greek. Okay, upsilon and iota together is the we like in sweet, and epsilon and upsilon together is the u as in feud. Okay? So be careful of those diphthongs when you run into them. Most Greek words syllabalize. I think that's a real word. If it isn't, gosh darn it, it is officially now. Most Greek words break into syllables in between their vowels, or you have consonant, vowel, consonant, or after a vowel, except when you have these diphthongs, and they never break syllable-wise. They will always be within the same syllable. What you've just gotten in the past 72 minutes is how to read and pronounce Koine Greek. Now, you just need to do it a lot. When you get your interlinear, read it out loud. If you're embarrassed, if there are people in the house, go someplace where folks can't hear you. If that's absolutely impossible, you live in a monastic cloister that the abbot does not allow you to have any time by yourself. You always are surrounded by other monks. Move your lips when you read, even though you're not making the sound out loud. Engage yourself physically for reading the text. That's the only way you're going to learn this stuff quickly. When Paul wrote, Paul spoke what he was writing, and what was called an amanuensis wrote down what Paul was saying. It was as if Paul was preaching and there was a person in the front row taking shorthand like a court reporter. We know that because in the text itself, Paul says, look, I've written these last letters to you so that you know this is really from me, even though his amanuensis copied it, right? The language was said out loud. It was read out loud to people, right? Our idea of reading by ourselves quietly without our lips moving and just in a corner somewhere, that's more modern, okay? To fully get this stuff, you need to do it out loud. Paul spoke it out loud when it was written. You should read it out loud. And it's not going to go quickly. I guarantee it. You know, I don't know, 30 years ago or more when I started studying Greek, you know, I would open the text up and I would read, ha de Jesus, Jesus, gnus. I struggled with saying it out loud. I guarantee you're going to do the same thing. If you pick it up and you can read ha de Jesus, guns anakathankon, ekinai, kai, if you're barreling through it, more power to you. You're better at this than me and you should be up here probably. You need to take your time. You need to read it slowly out loud. The same way when you were little and you were reading those books. Look, see spot, run. You had to sound out spot, right? spot. Same thing with the Greek. So now that you know this, this week, play with it and write English words in Greek. Or, I don't care, write Spanish words or Italian words. What, you use any language you want. Doesn't matter to me. Good luck trying to get Mandarin, but try to write words using the Greek alphabet. Write your name. Write your wife's name or your brother's name or your aunt's name. Write the name of the building you're in. Write your street name. Write whatever you want. Just write stuff in Greek. A good sentence to write that's a lot of fun is a sentence that you learn in English. The quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog. Why is that a good sentence, John? Well, because it uses every English letter. All the letters of the alphabet are contained in that sentence. The quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog. That's a great sentence to write in Greek, right? Using Greek letters. Okay? And try to find words that you have to think, oh, what letter would I use to make that sound? Remember, alphabets are abstract symbols that stand in place of the sound that we make when we speak. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to match sound for sound here. Any questions about this? Okay? All right. Next week, I am more than happy to answer questions about pronunciation or reading or any of that stuff. But next week, we're going to start getting into the real meat and potatoes of Greek. We're going to start talking about nouns next week. All language is divided basically into three parts. Noun stuff, verb stuff, and all the other little connector words. Okay? So everything we study can be in one of those three categories. Traditionally, when we learn Greek, we start out with all the noun stuff, which is nouns, pronouns, adjectives, right? And then we take verbs up, right? So next week, we're going to start looking at nouns. This is where we're going to start learning how Greek differs from English and what some of the, how the grammar differs and whatnot. But again, through this whole process, practice reading the text. I think next week we actually start looking at our text the first time, don't we? The syllabus. I thought that week three was the... Week three, we start reading Ephesians 2, verses 8 through 10. So the syllabus is in the front part of your notebook. And if you get your interlinear, or if you already have it, go to Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 through 10, and that should be a good practice text for you to read out loud. Okay? And we're going to look at that. That's got those two verses, 8, 9, 10, three verses, are just jam-packed with amazing Greek stuff in those three little verses that Paul wrote. It's also probably the best verse in the whole Bible that explains sort of technically how this whole salvation thing works. Because the Bible talks a lot about salvation. This is sort of the owner's manual, the technical instructions for salvation in Ephesians 2, 8 through 10. So we're going to start looking at that next week. Any questions on stuff? All right, then get out of here, you guys. Go enjoy the rest of the evening. I will see you next week.